All right. So you've heard this stuff about the drama with Peskov, who's been the Kremlin spokes for a while. He's been the spokesperson for the Kremlin for some time. So I think this is an interesting question, and so I kind of address it first. And I'm going to say things that maybe don't make sense to people immediately, or maybe are outside of the framework that they're comfortable with thinking about things, but floating different narratives and having things be unclear from official sources is not a Russian way, but it's a very important piece of technology in how to do things that Putin picked up from Trump. And in fact, there's been numerous technologies, communications and power structures that the two had shared. And this thing where Peskov says things that are kind of totally different from what Putin would say is a new phenomenon. This didn't happen until after Trump came. So Trump had a thing where the White House didn't say exactly what was the accurate, word from Putin or whatever, or didn't quite exactly stick to the approved talking points, and that's a technology. Okay, that's a technology. It serves a very important purpose in information war. You just have to use your head a little bit and not be driven by narratives like somebody so close to Putin would go off script in the middle of a war. Like, that's not even a rational, that's not even a coherent approach to understanding how power structures work. Like, right now in Russia, it's very hard to do all kinds of things because of this conflict. Like, there are controls on what different levels of people and regional governments can say and do. It's pretty regulated right now. So this idea that Peskov is doing things or saying things that are like totally, not what he's supposed to is not correct. Everything serves a purpose. The same thing with the chief negotiator for the Russian side. The things that he was saying, all these things are playing a role. You just have to know what the game is and what it is that they're trying to project, what it is that they're actually trying to accomplish with it. So now, Peskov saying that Russia has taken significant losses is not a numerical statement. It's an impression. I mean, it's a subjective opinion about what significant is, and just like so Trump had something very, very famous he once said in the first year or even months in office, because people were speaking for him from his campaign, from his team, and he, from his administration, from his cabinet, and he would say, I want these people to say whatever it is that they think, but it's sometimes I hear the stuff that they say and it's just crazy to me. It's not at all what I've said, or it's not at all what my policy is. And he was very clear. He's like, only when I speak is it actually what I've said. That's why, and he was setting it up for like, what is the importance of this of his Twitter account and stuff like that. So that was always him. And the things that he put in his Twitter were so important that even even typos and misspellings seemed to have an important message, because there would be some double meaning or some double entendre or something like this. So this is a very useful technology that Putin began to use after Trump. So you don't see Peskov going off of script, or there being this kind of staged melodrama about who said what, until Trump introduces this very useful tool, very useful tactic. Now, it should be immediately obvious to you why that's an important and useful tactic, because it can be something which is not what the president has said. It can be interpreted by media to be the official line. And then whatever the reaction to that is can be, as it can just be what they're actually trying to float, and it not be the policy at all. And then they can clarify, you know, Putin can clarify, say, no, that's not the policy at all. I sometimes I wonder these things he says, and it sounds crazy to me. And that's exactly, it's almost like verbatim what Trump said first. It's a very important technology, a very useful tactic in information warfare. Absolutely. I mean, we saw this happen in real time when it developed. We're in a moment where there are lots of actions going on. There's been lots of strikes on important infrastructure. It looks like some group carrying something was hit very badly, and there's some indication that this was the latest group of weapons or more that were coming in from Europe, and that was done right as the so-called land lease thing was being announced by the U.S. So this has a similar effect as like striking the remember the international brigades for the defense of Ukraine that were training at that spot, and they got hit, and like 140 some of them died, whatever it was, 130, 140 of them died. And these are the real messages, and you have to control the news cycle, okay? And you have to control what your own side is chattering about, because the other side is going to focus on what you're chattering about to see what you think is important and start to launch their responses to that. And then it's over who's driving the narrative, and then what narrative you're delivering. And many of those things could be absolute, not at all what your most important strategic focus is. So you want the information war to focus on something else. And that is an example of creating a distraction. Now, people who are absolute war gonzos and war trained spotters and war nerds can have the attention span to follow multiple things at once. They can follow what's happening in Mariupol, or they can follow the expulsion of Russia from the UN Human Rights Commission, and they can see that Russia was hitting these shipments coming in from the Polish border or something like that. So many big things happen at once. So when Peskov says, like, oh, we've taken significant losses, he hasn't floated a number, which is different from, you know, whatever the number Russia is claiming. And I would say that the real number is like double what Russia is claiming. I think they have an interest in, you know, understating that number, but I don't think that they are, you know, there are ways. What happens is the number one cause of death is damage to the head. And so the number two, you know, cause of death is traumatic brain injury, and a lot of soldiers go into a coma. So they might not die in the battlefield, And so there's just like there's, and I know this isn't like very honest or anything. I'm just saying how fucking reality works, excuse my French, but just how it works in reality is that you have, let's say a soldier gets hit and he's a goner, but because of your supply line and your first aid and your ability to evac them, you put them on life support. And then they're like in a hospital in, you know, probably Belgorod or something like that, or maybe in Belarus, maybe in Minsk or something. And they're like on life support. And they may be doing some kind of accounting method in which guys that die in the hospital are not considered killed in action. And that's normal. The U.S. does that too. So that's not killed in action. Now they'll probably still qualify for, you know, whatever the payments to the families were. And that's probably more like, if you were to try to find that number, like what are the number of families that qualify for the payment for personnel lost in the conflict, would probably be closer to like 3,000 or 4,000 dead. More than 1,700 or whatever they're claiming. So I would look at that injuries number, and then I would look from the injuries number, whatever that number is that they're claiming. I don't know if it's 5,000 or 7,000 non-death casualties. And then I would look at that number to see who actually is no longer alive. And that's different from killed in action. Does that make sense? So they're not, I mean, it's like lying by statistics, you know. It's not an honest representation, but the way that bureaucracies work, there's no one particular who has the job that has to go home and be like, I'm lying about this. Cause it's like, well, they have it in their mind. Like, well, we're reporting the killed in action. And then they're like, well, we don't control how, the press reports that. We told them we have this number killed in action, cause that's what the number that we're briefing to talk about is killed in action. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just taking a PFA value and saying, you know, from looking at how these things go. Now, I will share with you ridiculousness. I mean, shameful ridiculousness. I grew up watching PBS, public broadcasting. I grew up watching that stuff as a little kid. I used to watch Nova and all that space stuff and all those documentaries and English dramas and stuff like that. But I remember even as a kid that when you looked at who was sponsoring those, it was always like, the Ford Foundation, the Kellogg's, the W.M. Keck Foundation, General Electric, General Motors, basically the more friendly parts of the military-industrial complex, and then a few of the philanthropic, you know, groups, how they existed in the 80s, like, you know, when I was a kid, like in the 1980s, like how, you know, what that was like. And now PBS, I never would have thought that they would have reported like this. So PBS is saying that, and they're just reporting what NATO said, but the way that they edit the sentences, they're not quoting, so they decontextualize what's been quoted, and then they just write it like it's a fact. And this is a CIA method of writing, so it's very disturbing to see PBS doing this CNN style of writing. And they say, Kiev, Ukraine. Well, they're just floating this wire from Associated Press, which is a despicable fake news outlet. And it goes, NATO estimated on Wednesday that 7,000 to 15,000 Russian soldiers have been killed in 4 weeks of war in Ukraine. This is March 23rd. So this is like 2 weeks ago. And then they say, by way of comparison, Russia lost about 15,000 troops over 10 years in Afghanistan. A senior NATO military official said that the alliance's estimate was based on information from Ukrainian authorities. Comma, what Russia has released, intentionally or not, what is that? And intelligence gathered from open sources. Well, we know what open sources are. Open sources is just like assholes like me who run Telegram channels and try to figure out what's going on. But there's also another group of assholes called OSINT Ukraine, open source intelligence on Ukraine. They have a logo and everything. And they just republish and amplify the Ukrainian figures without questioning them. I'm always trying to question the figures on either side. I'm always trying to look and see like what things look like. Now, we recently saw something interesting, and I'm looking for further confirmation, but we published it earlier today. Again, when I say we, that's the royal we, as in me, myself, and I. And we published it earlier today as saying that the numbers, well, where the fuck is that? It was a screenshot of a tweet about the numbers. Yeah, okay, then it's earlier. Just pulling this up. That's interesting. Yeah, here it is. We actually ran it on the on April 6th. So Carl Quintanilla, who's a blue check marker, yesterday took sources from Fundstrat, CFR, that's the Committee on Foreign Relations, CNN, the Ukraine Ministry of Defense, and the Russia Ministry of Defense. And they kind of took all this, and then they have a data science team who's been tracking casualties and losses associated with the Ukrainian war. And this is what they come up with. So for whatever reason, they didn't look at personnel. They're looking at equipment. Okay. And it looks like Ukraine has lost 100% of helicopters. 100%. Now, 100% doesn't mean they don't have any more. It means that they have the pre-invasion number and then lost since the invasion. So the pre-invasion number is what they had. And then lost since the invasion is what's been documented. So that could have been that the pre-invasion number was wrong, because we know that they were arming up rapidly ever since the past year and a half. They've been really, really arming up very quickly, mostly through lateral pressure from the Biden administration. Not Biden, because he doesn't even know where he is, but that's why you have losses higher than the pre-invasion number, because that number, the pre-invasion number was probably not taken like as a snapshot since 2020 or 2021, so that number had gone up. And then also they've had stuff shipped in a lot, especially UAVs. We know that. We know Turkey and countries have been sending in those UAVs, right? So that explains the helicopters and UAVs. So they've lost 100% of helicopters, 100% of UAVs, 95% of aircraft, 91% of their tanks. That's, they've lost 1,900 out of 2,100 tanks. They've lost 56% of their air defense systems, 57% of their armored vehicles, and 43% of their artillery. That's why you hear all this stuff about sending more stuff, and are they going to step it up? Are they going to send offensive equipment? You know that to date, that all the equipment to date is considered to be, it could be dual use, but it has to be primarily defensive equipment. Isn't that interesting? Anti this and anti that. Did you know that? That's where Europe's real commitment has been so far. Now we're going to tie together this piece and the Peskov piece and the withdrawal from Kiev piece as well. It wasn't really a withdrawal, but people use that word so much that I don't need to talk around it, whatever. I'll just call it withdraw so that people can have a association with the word and what we're describing, but it's, you know, more of a repositioning. So from the Russian side, they've lost 14% of their helicopters, 11% of their armored vehicles, 10% of their aircraft, 7% of their tanks, 6% of their artillery, 19% of their UAVs, and 2.5% of their air defense systems. And mind you, that Russia's in the position, Russia builds all these themselves. It's a huge fucking difference. Russia builds all of these themselves. There's orders going on right now. So in fact, there's been orders going on for a lot of this stuff since the beginning of the conflict. And of course, fake news reported that as evidence of very big losses. Now, when you look at, but by the numbers, I gave you the percent so you can see that the demilitarization component by equipment is practically a mission accomplished. You can see how the serious degradation of the Ukrainian ability to project force when Shoigu announced that phase one had been a success. This is what they're looking at. I mean, maybe those numbers have come up a few percents, but I'm sure it was all over the 80-90% range when Shoigu made that announcement that they had succeeded in the completion of phase one. Not, we have failed in phase one, and now here comes plan B. That's a totally different non-reality that's being projected into people's minds about this. It's totally fucking bizarre. So, and we said, would they pull off these, whatever you want to call them. The Russians are calling them, what are they calling them? Well, they did call them a false flag at the UN. They did call it a false flag at the UN. They did. But they also call them provocations. All right, I am digging into the rest of your question. So that's the Peskov stuff. Kaczynski asks, where does Western sanctioned political punishment of Russia go from here following its removal from the United Nations Human Rights Commission? There's just very little political punishment that can happen right now. There's only one thing that really matters, and it's, can Europe receive fuel from Russia? That's it. Everything else is like sticks and stones can break your bones, but words will never hurt you kind of stuff. And these are just words. The whole UN has been pretty much broken outside of the Security Council is the only thing that has been functional. Okay. And the US had taken unilateral actions numerous times based upon UN Security Council resolutions that countries had agreed on. But the language of those resolutions didn't say, and if the party in question, the country in question, doesn't meet this standard, then any one of the Security Council countries can just take an action on them then and there. That's not at all how the UN Security Council was envisioned to work. But international law is also, because you're talking about customs and you're talking about laws between countries. Does that make sense? So there aren't rulings on these things. It's just, what's the convention? These things had been challenged unsuccessfully. So when the UN took, sorry, when the United States took unilateral action in Iraq, for example, on UN Security Council resolutions based on Iraq, it was challenged, okay, but the U.S. took unilateral action. So this is a precedent. And it's even stronger that it had been challenged unsuccessfully. Because now it becomes, in a sense, a new law. Because it was challenged, because the action was taken more than once. It's been happening more than once. And countries of the Security Council said, hey, you can't do it like this. And they said, well, we did. In fact, we're going to present the, remember Colin Powell and his little whatever. Okay. So all that Russia did is the same thing, because that's the law. It's more like a precedence. It's more like a common law. But that's how it worked. Not common law in the sense that people imagine common law, natural law. No, common law in terms of legal precedent. Legal precedent, common law. It's not in the code of the UN, but when parties believe that that code of the articles of the UN about aggression had been violated, that was unsuccessful. Because the law is actually, if you can get away with it, then you can do it. Like if you can point to a UN Security Council resolution, and then you can take action, and you can't be stopped doing it, so that none of your leaders or whatever are going to get arrested, and they're going to set up some new, you know, kangaroo court at The Hague or something. That's it. Then you do it. So there was a UN Security Council resolution. It was 2202 around the Minsk Agreement, and it's very clear that besides all of the other contingent enumerated parts, articles of the Minsk II Agreement, that Ukraine absolutely violated Article 4. And then they had been violating the ceasefire itself. They had been violating where they have their howitzers and the artillery, range artillery, in distance from the line of contact, which was the ceasefire line. They turned the line of contact at a certain point in time following the Battle of Debaltseve into the ceasefire line. And the Ukraine forces repeatedly violated the location of their defensive artillery, which they kept firing on civilians in Donetsk and Lugansk for 8 years. Thousands and thousands of people died. I never saw a PBS republish an AP article about thousands and thousands of people dead, you see? So the U.S. actually created the precedent for unilateral action based upon their unilateral interpretation of a UN Security Council resolution. Now, if they want to remove, if they can somehow, I don't think they can, but of course they can close off the airport. They can put sanctions on every single person in the Russian government so that they can't, their plane won't be allowed to land. Or they would be arrested when they arrive in New York. You know, the UN is in New York City, right? It's not like on an island in the Atlantic Ocean. It's not in some neutral thing. It's totally just in New York City. That's where the UN is. So they're going to not allow the Russian ambassador in there. not allow Lavrov, not allow, I mean, where things are headed, yeah, they that's how they would play the game. They can't really get them off the UN, but they can keep them, and then they're like, oh, well, you were no show. Now, I assume they can probably do a come in by Zoom. Because of COVID, we have this precedent of, you know, you can come, you can call in, and you can like, call into court on a video phone that you, for your DUI, and you can be drunk on the, they can't even tell you're drunk on the, on Zoom for your DUI court hearing. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, it's like, that's where the culture went. So I can see that they can try to take, you know, Russia just completely out of being able to arrive. Why not? Why not? And they can, and even if they could figure out some method of removing, I'm not saying this is even desirable or even necessary, but if they could remove Russia from the UN Security Council, that doesn't change anything. I mean, the UN really was supposed to freeze in time. Okay, the balance of power that existed at the end of World War II when the UN was established. And to keep exactly what we're seeing happen right now from happening. But now the UN had in its language and its concepts the framework for countries with stronger mercantile ability to effectively engage in a neo-colonial practice without overtly violating the UN language about aggression. And the nature of coups have always been treated as internal affairs within a country, even though typically coup plotters have contacts and support from outside the country. But you'll find very, very little international law about coups. Only that the government that establishes itself after a coup is generally considered to still have the same obligations as the like financial, like loans and stuff like that. Any successor state is considered to have the same agreements and obligations in standing place as the government that was overthrown. And one reason of that, of course, is that, you know, it prevents elites within a country from simply staging a fake coup and then declaring a new government as a way to get out of, you know, IMF loans or maybe a reduction of force agreement or something, or to some claim over some disputed neighboring territory. I mean, so it makes sense that countries inherit all these things, even if they're couped themselves. But yeah, I mean, in reality, people understand that many coups are foreign financed. Okay, but the literature in international law is very deprived. It's very impoverished in that domain. So the UN has been effectively a non-functioning organization for a very long time. Very long time. It is convenient. It basically works very, basically the UN works very similarly to G7 or G20 or any of these others, except it allows representatives from every country in the world to involve in these committees and to have contact in a way that's coherent. And let me explain why. Time and calendar. There's only 365 or whatever days in a year. Traveling is difficult. You want your most competent chief, consular people in your diplomatic mission to be able to be at the UN. And it's kind of like networking at a party. It's like, oh, there's going to be this producer, this guy, this girl, this lady, whatever. They're all going to be at this place. So you can, you know, exchange business cards and start talking about things right then and there. So the UN and all the different subcommittees are very important for networking between countries of the developing world. And that's actually been a very good thing in developing stronger South-South, you know, global South direct relationships. It's been invaluable, really, instead of going through all these, you know, middlemen or countries that get invited to the British embassy for some soiree. These countries can have their own whatever social gatherings under the rubric of all these different committees, but nothing from the General Assembly is binding. There's been not a single UN resolution at the UN General Assembly by the rules of the General Assembly that has any mandatory nature to it at all. It just kind of gets an idea of exactly what you saw with this UN Human Rights Council vote. It's just sort of like, let's see which countries can show what clout they have over the leaders of which countries. That's it. It's purely in your mind. There's no legislative component. There's no economic component. There's nothing mandatory out of it. And if the UN wants to destroy itself, or if the people who control the effectively have all this juice want to destroy it in their attempts to flex, that's just like the Olympics. It's like excluding Russia from the Olympics. And it's just like, well, that doesn't mean that Russia doesn't have athletes. They just will have to have their own competitions. Or maybe they'll bring back to life some other alternate Olympics. You know, maybe the Olympics goes in two different directions, and maybe you see that first, and then maybe you see a new type of UN. I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, for a long time, it's been argued that seats should be by population representation, not by country, you know, because it's kind of like the Congress and the Senate, right? I mean, you have, you know, states with more population have more seats instead of just, you know, two representatives per each state in the Senate, which the Senate's important. But I'm just saying that there's been many different ideas about problems with the UN. Gaddafi spoke about those problems numerous times that he spoke at the UN, and he wrote a lot of briefs and white papers. Very prolific guy, actually. He wrote a lot of briefs and white papers talking about how to fix. He actually wanted to fix the UN. He actually wanted to fix it. I know. Poor guy got a bad rap. All right, let's see here. Yeah, so people want to know about why I say we should, like, I'm saying that people who really care about this and really want to connect something reality to what they saw with Bucha or Busha, okay, it's going to be Mark Zuckerberg. That if people could create a public information campaign or a pressure campaign or start memeing about that, like who's the real butcher of Busha, that's going to be Mark Zuckerberg. Okay, and let me just help. Once I say this, the dots are going to fucking connect like magic and be like, oh, okay. So look, have you seen all those like smartphone videos from people from like Australia and New Zealand or England? It's like those three countries, maybe Canada now too. And like police show up at your house and they say, we want to talk to you about something that you put on Facebook or something that you've been messaging in WhatsApp groups from your phone. What? What I put on Facebook? Yes, it seems that you are calling for people to violate the lockdown orders by staging a protest. And people are like, either no, we didn't, or, but the so-and-so said that protest and, you know, these rights to assembly don't count as breaking the blah, whatever. But then people say, well, we just came to warn you. Okay. And those are peaceful. Those are countries, peaceful countries. Those are not countries at war, except, you know, the war against their own people and lockdowns and shit. But, I mean, they're not at war with another country. Okay, and that's because law enforcement and intelligence service have a direct relationship with Facebook, that Mark Zuckerberg allows the intel of each country for law enforcement purposes. They don't need a warrant or a petition or a phone call. They directly go into your WhatsApp. They directly go into your Facebook Messenger, or they can track all the groups. They have all the what's it called? Like beta, like programmer rights. Like they can see the behind the fourth wall stuff. Like they can see, you know, exactly. They create schematics about who you talk to and stuff like that. So they can easily go in. So now it's like, what about when people were saying like just in messages on their phone, like on WhatsApp or on Facebook, like, oh, I'm so glad that the Russians are here. Now, do you think those fucking Azov guys are just going to knock on your door and be like, oh, sir, may I come in? And are they going to fucking shoot you? Mark Zuckerberg has blood on his hands. This is exactly the standing policy that they have with Ukraine. This is coming off the heels right after saying we're going to allow Ukrainians to call for death to Russians. AP broke the story. Reuters broke the story. Very interesting, because Reuters doesn't do this normally, but other media covered up the fact that the original Reuters actually said to kill Russians. Now, later they tried to make it sound including Russian forces and Vladimir Putin. But those aren't exclusive clauses. Those are inclusive clauses. So it was like kill all Russians or the soldiers or Vladimir Putin. But they wanted to make it sound like that it was not what you thought. It was exactly what you thought. That's the same Facebook. And they have agreements with the SBU. And the SBU is directly reading people's stuff. They know exactly who the pro-Russian people are all throughout Ukraine. Okay. That has been a huge part of these SBU detention centers, these torture chambers. It's been a huge part of it. Z asks, what will happen if Finland applies for NATO? I don't know. It's symbolic. It doesn't really matter. This is what really matters. What matters is if there's some radical change in NATO that requires an automatic response to any type of military involvement of any NATO member state. That's all that really matters. The issue of NATO is almost convoluted. The issue of NATO and focusing on NATO as the reason for... I'm going to say some things that are maybe difficult for people to understand or they don't want to hear it, but even though we heard the news that Scholz said... Now that, yeah, before, you know, around February 15th, there was very clear attempts by Russia. I recommended, you know, Scholz, this is Scholz speaking, Scholz saying, I recommended to Ukraine that they opt for an agreement of neutrality, an agreement they're never going to join NATO. Yeah. This is all a confusion. This is all a ruse, okay? Russians don't care about NATO. There doesn't have to be a NATO. NATO could disband. It could not exist, and all the threats would still be there. You just have a bunch of countries, and each of them can opt to send what weapons they want or to send their armies in or not. NATO doesn't require, actually. It's like the Article 5 process is not automatic. That's if you're attacked, not if you opt to go into an adventure, first of all. So if you are attacked. So, in other words, if Poland goes in to Ukraine and confronts Russian soldiers, that does not trigger that now it's a dogpile and every NATO country has to jump into the conflict in Ukraine. Not at all. That's not how NATO works. Okay? If Russia attacked Poland first, then Poland If they want to involve NATO, it's up to them. Yeah, it's actually up to them. If they want to involve NATO, then they have to say, then they have to ask. They put in a petition on, they claim Article 5, okay, and then NATO has to determine the response. Poland doesn't get to say, we're going to have 500 tanks from Bulgaria, we want to have the U.S. come and do a nuclear strike. It doesn't make the leaders of the Polish military into the leaders of every single European country plus Canada and the U.S. at what how they want it. Okay, it ain't fucking Burger King. It ain't, you know what I'm saying? So that's not how NATO works. Now, but the concept of NATO is, for some reason, in the public mind, it's NATO. In the public mind, it's NATO. Russia already has been in a proxy war against Turkey in Syria, and they even had dogfights and a Turkish fighter shot down a Russian fighter. It was a surprise attack. The Turkish plane was not set to trigger off the, the friend or foe warning system. Like the Turkish planes were set to not foe, you know, friend. They were set to friend, and the Turkish plane shot down the Russian plane. Turned out that pilot was a member of a cult inside of Turkey that would then try to overthrow Erdogan. But they first tried to create an international incident that would trigger Russia and Turkey to increase the hostilities. And Turkey is a NATO country. But do you really think that Greece, which is a NATO country, would come in on the side of Turkey? Or would they use the fact that Turkey is having a conflict with Russia to solve problems in Cyprus and solve problems with, you know, all these islands? There was some bad reversals after World War One. There was some real bad reversals after World War One about the peace agreements, and Greece got the shaft, it looks like. So they've been real mad about that, because the agreements that ended at World War One were not the finalized versions or something like that. I could be mistaken, but I think it's something like that. If you guys know, let me know in the comments. But I think I'm right about that. Next question is, question, you said in case of nuking, one of the best places would be Latin America. Why are you then staying in Europe? Because I just don't think that things are going in the direction of nuking, but I was asked, what about in the case of nuking? I didn't say that I thought nuking was probable, but yeah, I have people in Mexico, I have people in Argentina, I'll blend right in. I would go by a Spanish-sounding suit. Oh, no, wait. I wouldn't have to. Yeah, I would just fucking blend right in. Yep. Latin America is the best place because there are no nuclear strike targets there, and it's real far away. There's, like, water, and it's surrounded. It's, you know, oceans do a good job with dissipating some of this, you know, surface radiation stuff, and the more rainforest you have, the canopies, the trees and stuff absorb a lot of the radiation to begin to metabolize it a lot faster. Just study this stuff. You'll see Latin America is the place in terms of radiation and food supply, Latin America. Now, Africa, it may be similar, but I just said, like, I just think that in terms of not standing out, I mean, if you're black, yeah, Africa might be a better place, or Brazil, but if you are within the bandwidth of almost like any other, you know, phenotype on the planet, including East Asian to Northern European to Mediterranean to Latin, you know, you actually kind of can blend in Latin America. Like, if you look at some Central Americans, look almost like they're from China. There's different tribes and different indigenous people from like Peru and stuff. Like, Peruvians can look Chinese, totally can look Chinese. Almost whatever you are, you can blend in. You know, Middle Easterners blend into Latin America, have for centuries. I mean, there's millions of Lebanese in Mexico that people just assume are Mexican. Like, Salma Hayek is Lebanese. Carlos Slim is Lebanese, right? The Mexican billionaire oligarch is actually Lebanese. But you look at them and they just blend right in. And of course, you know, that's the history of Spain. I mean, they're, you know, Phoenicians, Carthaginians, right? They're Lebanese of the Spanish are like, except for the, you know, the Visigothic Spanish, but like the non-Visigothic Spanish are just actually from, you know, Lebanon. Originally, right? That's where the Carthaginians came from. They were like the Phoenicians that went westward, right? So you can blend into Latin America real easily. There's all kinds of different people anyway. There's like a lot of Japanese anyway in Brazil. A lot of Japanese in Brazil. And the language is not that hard, you know, it's not that hard. I think Africa would be real hard, especially if there was like a global economic crisis that comes with a nuclear war. I think Africa would be real hard. I mean, just talk to people from Rhodesia. That's, it doesn't exist anymore, but talk to people from who were from Rhodesia or who, you know, people talk to people from South Africa, since the collapse of the apartheid system. And I'm not saying it was a good system. I'm just saying, talk to them if you want to know about their security risks and their security issues now. They have like 9 and 15 foot walls and they still got dudes fucking doing backflips and, you know, magical gymnastics like over the walls and shit. You have to consider like any post-nuclear scenario is very much like a zombie apocalypse. For the past 3 years on and off, this is the guy's question, right? This is a Blaje Saweri. You people with your fucking names. For the past 3 years on and off, I'm getting thoughts about Russia. Do you recommend moving there? I know about good tax, simplified immigration laws, and also 1 hectare rule if you marry Russian wife or gain citizen status. Yeah, I'm going to be talking to people about that soon too. I'm going to be looking at, you know, with my colleague Tim, showing people how they can, we're going to set up an immigration service. So people can move to Russia if they want. Actually, I'll just let it out of the, I'll just let it out now. We're going to actually start pretty soon. I'm actually setting up in Serbia because Serbia can do all the business with Western countries in the US and also can do with Russia. Serbia is like the one, a huge loophole around, well, not around sanctions. To clarify, it just doesn't pertain, the sanctions just don't pertain to Serbia. And your intentions were to deal in Serbia, not to do something else by which Serbia is getting around anything. It just, you just intended to do Serbia. So yeah. Ringing cedars of Russia, no idea. I'll go to the next question. Considering you shared alien news, Project Bluebeam should be shared with class by SM as SM1 as eloquent as you. Thank you. I may lose some of you. I may lose some of you. talking about this. For those who've been following me for a while, look, I appreciate everyone. Maybe, you know, you're a Russophile, or you're just anti-war, or you're maybe of the old left, or you're of the European anti-war movement, or, you know, just an independent critical thinker and stuff. But I suspect that a lot of the people that I've picked up on this channel, as I've focused heavily on this conflict, because I covered it as a journalist and analyst 8 years ago very heavily. And my obligations in life have shifted since, and the viability of covering it in a more rigorous way, although I've been fairly good with this channel, I have a family now, I'm married now, many things have changed in 8 years. Things, risks that I might have entertained taking or thought about I could take, I guess I'll say, my lawyers advised me to say, are not things I would do today or even consider doing today. But I speak on the matters of the ins and outs as an outsider, as a non, you know, Russian with all the, who, with all the details of all the personalities involved. I'm not an expert, you know, by any means. I'm simply very informed and highly conversant, on the matter. And, now the American criteria for being called an expert on Russia is actually very low. And I do meet that criteria, but I just know that I don't know anything compared to a highly literate or reasonably literate Russian who knows, you know, their own country. And because a lot of these things are like the dynamics of the, you know, the sociological stuff and everything like that, right? but actually, my contacts, I can't speak about that much. People who know me, if you actually can, you can actually find that I was a subject of the Mueller investigation, and in connection with the you know, the part about the Russian part of it. And I don't want to get into it, but I have been under investigation for quite some time. And even though Mueller found that there were no Americans who did any wrongdoing, and I am an American, I know that they never really stop investigating people. And now, don't get me wrong, there's nothing that I did that I think is wrong, or either more ethically or legally. But I also understand that the nature of investigations is to dig and dig and dig until you can, you know, create a narrative that a judge would find admissible enough to bring to recommend, you know, maybe a grand jury or something like that. So, an indictment or something. And so I won't get into, but I can say that you can find me, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, discussed my work. By the way, they said that nothing I said was actually wrong. They just said that it was within the context of trying to sow doubts. Well, no, that was another investigation. That was the Treasury Department. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Oh, to undermine Americans' confidence in their institutions. That's it. To undermine Americans' confidence in their institutions. Okay. And then the Treasury Department has been investigating me for some time. I'd actually just received a letter on March 8th from them. My work featured in their report on saying that Russia was actually driving the COVID denial narrative. That, which is ridiculous. This is more like mama bears. Mama bears are driving the COVID denial or the vaccine hesitancy narrative. It's mama bears. Because once you start talking about putting your hands on kids, you know, you mothers don't like that stuff. Mothers who are not, you know, down with the program. But they wanted to make that be like Russia is engineering global or Western opposition to the lockdowns. Because, you know, you need a foreign government to convince civilians that they don't want to be locked down, right? So, you know, the belief is that I have connections with, you know, Russian intelligence operations and all these things, and that maybe I'd be privy to things or okay. Let's put that aside. Let's forget about all of that. Let's say that every country has projects about understanding certain phenomenon, like that tiny fraction of difference that human thought has on the outcome of random number generators. Or the concentrated studies on dreams which have higher correlation to future events than not, like statistically improbable correlation with future events. Yeah. Many things involving dreams, in fact, are apparently, so the rumor goes, the subject of intelligence projects. And aspects of what in conventional nomenclature would be called the supernatural, I guess, for lack of a better word. Okay. So, once you actually peel back the layers of the claims about UFOs, okay, once you peel back the accepted mainstream, you know, what the academic consensus is about the hypotheticals about it. Like, okay, once you peel those layers back, then you can actually see a much more probable or closer alignment to the opinion that I have come to have through, let's say, through my experiences and my knowledge. And, the actual hypothetical view about the, and also based on the whole collection of eyewitness testimonies, and we just shared a story about 1,500 cases. This is one of many things are coming out, and intelligence organizations have been coming forward and doing limited hangouts, but definitely affirming in the positive that these crafts are not from this realm, and I'm going to use those words very, very carefully. This realm, okay. The consensus view, and then based upon also the testimony, but also just the logic of it, and just the understanding of physics, and the understanding changes. Don't get me wrong; this is not the end of history, and science will keep uncovering new things. But just the consensus view is that. Is that these things, okay, even though that they appear as physical craft in the sky, in a sense that they have, you know, apparent mass and definite orthogonality. I mean, they exist and you can see them in a location, so they have orthogonality. They have dimension. But the view is that they travel via consciousness. That the distances involved require conscious information manifestation. In other words, that they travel through something that works like instantaneous travel, okay, manifestation, realization. That's actually what consensus view is on beings from other planets. But I think that if we apply Occam's razor, okay, we're actually adding an inelegant burden to that. Like, let's agree with it just hypothetically. Okay, they manifest. To say that they come from another distant planet, okay, actually is a higher burden of proof and actually adds inelegantly to a step in the explanation, which the explanation should simply be that through consciousness they materialize. So you don't have to suppose or create the presupposition that they are matter over here, far, far away on a planet like Earth, but more advanced or whatever, or everything's water or everything's pink or whatever, like in movies, like, okay. And then they turn into thought and then they materialize here in, you know, in the sky. That's adding steps, and that's not elegant, right? It's only based on a presupposition that where they come from is a material place, and that they created a technology of then dematerializing into consciousness and then rematerializing here. So, the problem is that people's experiences with these entities are always very negative. And this is highly problematic. This is actually very problematic because they're negatives. Let me just look at something. Okay. There was a guy, I just wanted to get his name right. I've talked about him before. Okay. You know, the UFO thing, and, you know, you picked up really huge, you know, is in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And now this involved, now one of the big UFO people who actually had some bona fides under his belt and was actually a scientist, actually an astronomer, I believe, and actually was documenting these things. And he developed some kind of celebrity status within the UFO truther community, you know, back 45 years ago, 50 years ago, like mid 70s, early 70s, okay. And his name was Jacques Vallée. But based upon his interpretation of the data, he just started to find too many parallels in the narratives of UFO abductees and the same stories from the medieval period about people's experiences with gnomes and elves. I know that sounds weird, but he found too many identical narrative parallels that went back to the medieval period where people had these very same experience with gnomes and elves. And they were negative experiences, which means that people were feeling fear. Okay. Excuse me if I jump around a little bit with concepts and if I pivot, you know, sort of horizontally, but I'm going to stay within this circumference of ideas and I hope you can hang with me a little bit. But suppose if you would that these entities which emanate through consciousness and respond to consciousness have been around for time immemorial. You know, they're part of the human experience and they materialize and dematerialize. Okay. Now people, it was common in culture to talk about these things and these experiences, things that go bump in the night and whatever, through the, you know, all the centuries. Okay. But then we seem to arrive at the cusp of the 20th century, and we have this whole thing arise that I talked about in my second seminar in January. My video seminar, it was a 3-hour seminar called Proof of God. And I showed how that the concept of science versus religion was a mid-late 19th century construct, and that scientists had generally been fairly religious. It doesn't mean that they were didactic or dogmatic or devout in the sense that some people are more devout than others, but there seems to be a general understanding that prior to the 19th and 20th centuries, that scientists generally believed that the things that they were discovering how God works in the world or how God had built things. And there were different iterations. I mean, even in the Victorian period, you had this idea of a clockmaker God, you know, the Victorian era conception of God is a distant God who kind of set things up, and not a particularly moral God, just a clockmaker, more of a demiurge or like a Metatron, sort of just keeping how all the things work, keeps the planets rotating, kind of set everything up and kind of created the laws of physics and then said goodbye, but doesn't really play any direct role in your personal lives, if that makes sense. And that kind of gave way into the general secular, you know, atheist worldview. They just had to drop that clockmaker, and, you know, they had already depersonalized God. And why am I saying this? And this will make sense. There had always been tons of eyewitness accounts of materialization of entities in one's home, in outside windows, things in the night sky. Every culture, every historical record has these, okay? But it's right around the time that the and I know this is going to make you laugh at first, but when we think about it, just, you know, just bear with me and please be tolerant, okay? Right around the same time that cameras became more common, I mean, cameras existed in the 1860s and a little before then, but by the turn of the century, it was possible for a lot of people to have cameras and take pictures. Okay. And people did take a lot of pictures of these things. And of course they were fakes, because there was a lot of yellow journalism stuff. And, you know, the ones that looked more clear and looked like airbrush and, or looked like collage and cut out and pasted and then whatever probably are right. The ones that are less clear might've been more real. I don't know. But the point is that, kicking out the fakes, people are certainly photographing things and photographing, you know, entities. And at the same time in history, exactly the same time, the whole science fiction thing was launched into culture. And so now these things, which for thousands of years people had experienced as being supernatural beings and otherworldly in the sense of dimensions, right, are now being explained as otherworldly in terms of that these beings come from other planets, right? That in the same way that we live on a planet, that these objects in the sky are massive. That had been a belief since the 1500s, that the objects in the sky, not the stars, but that the planets were worlds like the one that we live on. And so it began to be thought that, you know, by the 1870s, 1880s, there was strong view that beings like us lived on those planets like Mars or whatever, Neptune, etc. Okay. But there was a big cultural push to make these things be what we call aliens, when historically they were understood as demons. That's all. That's all. I think that's what I wanted to say about that. But the point is that Jacques Vallée, he started off as a very materialist kind of ufologist kind of guy, very big, you know, celeb in the UFO truther community in the 70s. But then because he found this stuff and he began to assess these encounters, he actually began to see that the encounters that people were having had begun as pseudo or accidental initiatic ritualized ideations that then projected outward into the world, and from that calling or from that projection, these beings would manifest. And they were typically manifestations of fear, and later thinkers began to look at, okay, you know how like in the deepest like crevices of the earth, like the very deepest parts of the ocean, there's like cracks and like heat is coming up from you know, whatever, like the lava or whatever that's beneath the mantle or whatever, supposedly. Okay. And these are like, they get no sunlight and they do not eat any other creatures and they don't get any sunlight. They only live off of the energy, the heat from whatever, the lava, okay, beneath, coming out of these cracks, okay, at the deepest part of the oceans. It's impossibly dark there also. And it's highly salinated because the salt is actually coming out of there too. So it's like, to get into those areas, there's actually underwater lakes because it's a different type of fluid. Okay. It's a different type of fluid. That's, I think, highly salinated, and it has a mineral composition from the rock sediment deep down there that together makes it, I don't know if it has oil and salt, but it makes it not mix with the regular ocean water. So you can see these, and these have been, you know, like those, you know, like Jacques Cousteau and like those deep underwater things and people film. So you can see now there's like ponds and lakes underwater. Okay. And then it looks like the fish or like the manta rays look like they're birds flying over these lakes, and they maybe they'll dip in to try to catch something. And then just like how birds fly over lakes, okay, that these, you know, manta rays and whatever, different eels and stuff will go in and try to catch things that are deeper. Or you'll see the sea life that lives in that other type of water will be jumping out of the water, like in the same way that you see fish jumping out of the water, like on, you know, the land surface, right? Or the air into the air at sea level, rather. So there's all types of different life that lives off of all kinds of different things, even observable, like, okay, and I'm setting this up to understand this, okay? So there's this view that that these entities, that what they live off of are the, or what attracts them, or what they live off of, are your fears. That your fears are actually, like, you know, like when you're like in, you know, shark infested waters and you start to bleed, and that one drop of, you know, blood, and then the shark comes all the way for that blood. Well, imagine your fear, or your, like, your hormones, you have the fear response, and then imagine that there are like these entities that are drawn to that fear, or that they manifest in response to that fear, or that they are actually a conscious projection and a manifestation of your fears. Okay. And, you know, different cultures and stuff may call them demons or whatever. Okay. So Jacques Vallée wrote a book called Passport to Magonia. It's just a very, very, it's a combination of strange ideas. I mean, he took a lot of risks, and that's not in there with I'm talking about, you know, the fear response, but he saw these as somehow projections of mechanisms that reside deep within our own consciousness. But he wasn't saying that these experiences weren't real. So he does seem to be implying that these are actual beings and actual abductions based on beings that manifest as a product of your own consciousness. That seems very much to be like sin, like things like this. So I know it's a very complex subject, and you know, again, I don't want to turn people off. I just want to put these ideas out there to kind of help to provide some background. Now I take the approach of Occam's razor, and I would just say that if the consensus view already is that these beings that we see are actually consciousness manifestations, I mean, or that they respond, or that they travel through consciousness, so that not the thesis that they are coming, that they are somehow answering to your consciousness, okay, that's a different question, but that they use consciousness to materialize, I think it's inelegant to add to that they have traveled a great distance. Why not? They're just existing in a substrate that's embedded within this reality, or a subset of this reality all the time, and then they manifest into the domain of the observable within our sense perceptions, you know, under whatever conditions that, you know, whatever those are. That to me seems just more elegant, because there's already an agreement that these things travel using consciousness. That's been disclosed in lots of stuff that's been leaked, and whistleblowers and stuff. People have come forward, and that's already out there. That's already out there in the public domain. Okay. Now I think that there are sciences that are secreted or kept from our general understanding, or not talked about, because they have taken society and the narrative in a very materialist direction, so that the human beings that appear to have the most political authority and the most political power are the ultimate powers in your life. And that there's no higher calling or higher authority that people can say, like, well, you're breaking the rules of God or something like that. You see how that works? So it seems that scientism and the cult of materialism has been a psychological operation, very much heavily embedded into the, we call it the cabal, right? But what has infected and derailed the Western ethos, and prepared people to accept being ruled by people who create laws based on what they think and not, you know, without appealing to a higher authority. I'm not suggesting that historically governments that appeal to a higher authority, you know, accurately represented what that higher authority has said or would say or would do, but it's a criteria that allows authorities to be challenged in the best case scenario. Okay. And in the worst case scenario, a critic might say that this theocracy or whatever that is saying that this is the name of the God is actually not following, you know, the religion that they're claiming. Because if you actually look at most of these religions, they don't condone tyrannical or despotic governments. Okay. So it's a standard to live up to that has disappeared. Okay. Yeah, the greatest trick the devil ever played was making you think he didn't exist. So think about it in terms of that, but let me look at your questions. But so just long story short, I look at the UFO stuff that's coming out as not like a distraction. Like I know Project Blue Beam and stuff like that, but there's many, many other projects, okay? Using holographic projection for things could be part of a horror show, and that's certainly a known, it is a known written about plan of the intelligence organizations to claim that there's either an alien invasion or an alien arrival, and we have to listen to the aliens, what they're going to say, because they're here to bring peace. Okay. And that's already a known, already well-documented FOIA-released project, okay, that intelligence organizations have planned for any time they want to roll it out. And they had to prepare the population first that it's possible. Assumedly, there's been juntas or movements or counter moves against that, and maybe that's been delayed or whatever, however that kind of stuff goes down. All things are possible, so I don't get stuck on one narrative about it. But in general, it's a fact that it is one of many plans to say that aliens have arrived. And either we're now at war with them, or you had better listen to what they say because they're here to stop our wars. It's some idea that right we're in the middle of having all these wars, then they're going to appear and be like, don't do this, okay? And establish some kind of, you know, one world government based on aliens. But if they're just sock puppets, if they're just holographic images of what intelligence organizations are saying, then it would just be a giant hoax, you know? Priestly caste did hoaxes all the time. You know, they knew from the calendar when there was going to be like eclipses, and that regular people didn't know there was going to be an eclipse, right? They didn't know that it was like this mechanical thing that happened at a planned, at a known time. So priestly caste would be like, if God is angry with us, then, you know, and, or if we're right or if we're wrong, then, you know, let God cover the sun right now. And then like the sun would cover and be like, oh, right, you know, and then it's like, whoa, okay. So that kind of shit's been going on forever. I'm looking at your questions. Okay, let's take a look. Yeah, people were asking about aliens and stuff like this. Yeah, I did not make a second chat. Okay, so those are all your questions. Very good. Yeah, so those are just ideas to think about, you know. I'm not married to any particular view, but I would just say that it's normal for every society to view events through the lens of how they understand through their paradigm. So, you know, it makes sense that in the futurist scientific paradigm that that people would view those entities as being from other planets, because if we have the view that we as beings simply only exist in this realm and that we just exist on this planet, then ergo, when you see other beings that aren't from here, then you'd be like, what planet are they from? So that makes sense within our paradigm to think about it in those terms. It's not crazy. In fact, it's what this paradigm, in fact, you are crazy, or you're breaking the rules of science in the paradigm if you reach outside of that paradigm, okay? We haven't really fully hit the borders or limits of the paradigm that we're in, from which it would be acceptable to then propose those things that kind of connect between two paradigms. But I think one of the concepts that will connect between this paradigm and the next paradigm is going to be that, like I said, that consensus view that these beings are traveling through consciousness. And then the only difference that people who see the world through the lens of spirit and consciousness and the people who see the world through the lens of trying to make science fiction about space stuff into reality, that the only difference there is going to be, did the being start as matter and then travel through consciousness and then rematerialize, or do they just materialize and dematerialize in this realm? I tend to think that they just materialize and dematerialize from this realm. That's just what I think, okay? It seems more elegant, and it seems to... I just don't think that all these people's eyewitness accounts... And they're just universally just bad encounters with these ones that look like aliens. People only have good encounters with beings who appear as human beings, and then for whatever reason they turn around and they're gone, or they went down a street that doesn't have an exit and they're just not there, or whatever. Like people have good experiences. And they're always positive experiences, and it's always in the daytime, it's always in the light, it's always calm, like your heartbeat doesn't go up. Like if you have high emotional intelligence, you can never be confused if some entity is a problem or not. Okay. It's only people that are victims of abuse whose senses and boundaries are all fucked up, and who second guess themselves or who are shut off from their own emotional, their own ability to interpret their own emotional responses on a cognitive level, are the ones that aren't aware when bad things are happening to them, or that their feelings, that they don't have intuition effectively, is what I'm saying. Okay. Yeah, a lot of stuff happening at CERN. Anyway, I think that's good. You know, I wanted to get into some of these questions, and it was that one was very strange, but we answered it. And you know, that's just my opinion. My opinion comes from things. I've put a lot of thought into this stuff, just as much thoughtfulness as I put into these other questions. And I just, at this point in my life, it's more important to be my authentic self and to say what I think in ways that I think do it justice. I'm not here to offend anybody or anything like that. If I wanted, if I wanted in life, to be in a position where I couldn't say what I thought, I'd work for other people, and I'd probably still be in the United States or something like that, and be doing the grind and never able to say these things. So that's, you know, I think I've earned this right. I've fought for this right. And yeah, I'm, you know, university educated geopolitical analyst. I've worked many different projects with governments and political parties on these things. But I'm also a person like you who thinks about things and, you know, reads maybe parts of the Bible or parts of other old religious texts, and you start to put things together and see things through the lens, and the limitations of people's thinking are always contingent upon the historical paradigm from which they emerge, right? So it makes sense that we would think of things as, you know, I just kind of do a reversal on it. See, the physical material aliens from other planets crowd, they're aware that people have been seeing these things from the beginning of time. They're like, well, back then people were very primitive and stupid. And so then they thought that they were seeing supernatural entities when they were really just seeing aliens from other planets. And I would just flip that around. Because I don't think that people in the past, I don't think that people in the past were more ignorant. I think that it's a big folly of the present that, that's based on that flattery thing I told you about in psychological operations, to say that this is the pinnacle. I would surmise that in the distant past, you know, when you think about what's important in life and you think about what is good, okay, those things are not technology dependent, and there's not convincing evidence, in my opinion, that we're living any longer. Or that we're any happier, especially since we killed God. Ever since we killed God, we've created an existential crisis, and we've sought to have replacements for that. Some are individual dreams. Some are like to have wealth and fantasies, and you know, in your lifetime. Prostitutes and drugs and stuff, just hedonism is one substitute, and that crashes in a very ugly way at the end of your life. It's meaningless. In fact, it makes you bitter. In fact, I would say that much of the crisis of today's ruling class is their frustration and shock and loss and attachment to the problem of only a cruel God could have made, or only that existence is a cruel joke, that life is so good and you rise to the top only to die, to wither away and die and to age and stuff like that. It's just a dark and sad way of thinking about things, because there's so much evidence that God is real, and all that it requires for that reality to grow and for the evidence, and we're talking about empirical evidence to manifest, is just to accept the openness to the idea, and then all these things start opening up for you. But it's clear that the ruling class is either a product of or co-creating this crisis. It's an existential crisis. It's a very big crisis of our age when we killed God. And Yeah, I think that's just about it. I think I've said more than enough. All right, I'm out.